In this final essay, I want to discuss some reasons to cycle. I've already mentioned a few while pursuing other themes, but here I would like to marshal them systematically, and in talking about reasons to cycle, we necessarily encounter reasons not to cycle. At the peak of British cycling in the 1940s, the main reason to cycle was simply that you wanted to go somewhere, and the obvious way to do that was by bike. You might cycle to the local shops as naturally as you would walk from one room to another in your house. Cycling was the default transport mode for many people, and this was called utility cycling. We no longer have utility cycling in the UK, where just 2% of journeys are made by bike. The government, by the way, aims to bring that up to 5%, a modest aspiration. They do have utility cycling in Holland, where 27% of journeys are made by bike. Cycling UK, our main cycling campaign group, would like to restore utility cycling in Britain. And so would Andy Shrimpton, who would particularly like to restore it in York. We have already met Andy Shrimpton in these essays. He runs a chain of bike shops in York, my native city. I spoke to him in his largest premises, an airy Victorian building that used to be an army warehouse. Some of the bikes on sale were raised high on stands, and the customers seemed to browse reverentially, as in an art gallery. "The journey that brought me here," said Andy, "began back in the 1980s in Copenhagen. I was sitting in a quiet square, and I just couldn't believe I was in a capital city. It was as peaceful as a British county town." He realised the key to this tranquillity was bikes. Bikes coexisting harmoniously with trams. He was in Copenhagen to see a friend, and she didn't seem interested in cycling, but she did cycle. Andy recalls her saying, "Everyone cycles everywhere in this town." In those days, Copenhagen had a network of bike lanes. "But they've doubled provision since then," Andy told me. "They're on the way to going full Dutch," that being his term, "for the most comprehensive facilitation of cycling. Segregated bike lanes on almost every road. Flyovers to carry one bike lane over another. The dethronement of the car." A more recent inspiration is Ghent in Belgium. Andy Shrimpton described the Ghent Circulation Plan of 2017, by which cars were prevented from driving right across the city. They had to go round the ring road. Cars were not entirely banned from the centre, but they were drastically calmed. A road in Ghent might be two-way for bikes and buses, but only one-way for cars. Ghent has, in short, gone full Dutch. There were ructions at first, to the extent that the deputy mayor of Ghent had to have police protection. But now things have settled down. "Structures generate behaviour," says Andy, "and the cars in Ghent naturally defer to the bikes, whereas here we're trying to kill each other." He thinks Ghent, being a compact and beautiful historic city, might be a model for York, which he thinks could go full Dutch for less than a tenth of the 60 million being spent adding a new carriageway to its northern ring road. There's a hint of paradox about a cycle shop owner advocating utility cycling, because if it is achieved, the category of cyclist dissolves, since almost everyone cycles, and without self-consciousness. Putting on a bike helmet always makes me feel very self-conscious, partly because they look ridiculous. Like wearing dried bananas on your head, as Jeremy Clarkson once wrote. But it is the motorists, personified by Clarkson, who is actually also a cyclist, who have forced the helmet question. Cyclists wear helmets much as a soldier wears a tin hat, because they are going into a hostile environment, whereas on the cycle lanes of Amsterdam and other full Dutch places, helmets are not usually worn. The prevalence of helmets in Britain surely reinforces the belief, held by two-thirds of the adult population, that the roads are too dangerous for cycling. And this is the main reason for not cycling. In fact, cycling in Britain is safer than people think, 10.4 million trips for every fatality, and the risk is far outweighed by the health benefits. But objectivity goes out of the window for the cyclist being overtaken by a 30-mile-an-hour lorry on a 20-mile-an-hour road, or by a car observing the speed limit but still going at 60 miles an hour on a country road. Bicycle casualties have generally declined in recent years, but the latest figures show a rise in deaths and injuries on country roads, a phenomenon Cycling UK attributes to COVID driving. Motorists going for a spin during the pandemic and driving faster than usual, whether because of the quiet roads or out of light-headedness at a momentary freedom from lockdown. News of any bike accident gives pause to the most dedicated cyclist, and I am haunted by one cycling casualty in particular. The life's work of Roy England is enshrined in the model railway layout that is the centrepiece of the Pendon Museum in Long Wittenham, Oxfordshire. The layout evokes the countryside and the railways of the Vale of White Horse in the 1930s. From the 30s to the 80s, Roy England toured the Vale on his Dawes Racer, photographing and measuring buildings, which he then recreated in 1/76th scale, such that it might take him longer to model, say, a country inn, than it would have taken to build the original. So great was his attention to detail. In modelling the Vale, he was, he said, attempting to turn back the clock to the days before the chalk roads were tarred over, before the car came. As a young man, Roy England had ridden a motorcycle until he was involved in a collision with a car. Thereafter, he shunned automotive transport, and when he helped fund his museum by establishing a youth hostel in Long Wittenham, the venture succeeded owing to the patronage of the Silver Wing Cycle Club. But in 1986, aged 79, Roy England was hit again by a car while cycling back from Holy Communion one August morning. He was unconscious for 10 days. The Dawes was a write-off. The accident ended his railway modelling and marked the start of his final decline. It was as if he'd been killed by the enemy. Wariness of busy roads probably explains why far more people own bikes than ride them regularly, and there is something poignant about a new bike not coming into its true inheritance, but sleeping away its days in garage or shed. I've done some of my keenest cycling on a new bike. I want to test it out, to show it off, in hopes of being complimented on it, as I would with a new jacket. In 1978, the actor Eleanor Bron published Life and Other Punctures, about travelling around Europe on a Moulton bike. Moultons, small-wheeled but fast bikes, were highly fashionable when she bought hers in the mid-60s, flush with her early TV success. "Only the best was good enough now," she wrote. "The newest, most fangled. I splashed out on a Moulton, pale blue, deluxe model." She compares it to another purchase, the eye-level oven with the revolving spit. This is the perpetuation of a childhood emotion, excitement at having a new bike. But the very first cyclists were not children. Bikes only became toys, so to speak, in the 1920s, and today most children have bikes. Although rates of regular cycling to school among children in Britain, the only measure of child cycling, are low. A reason for a child to cycle might be to show off that they can cycle, and cycle well. Daisy Adams is a cycling influencer, described on the Cycling UK website as the youngest person ever to be included in the 100 Women in Cycling list. Daisy, I read, who rides her bike every day, can either be found carving up mountain bike trails, competing in races, or inspiring her many fans on social media with her bike skills and tricks. When that was written, Daisy was 3 years old. She is now, I believe, 4. She cycles in a full-face crash hat and tutu skirt, and the one is explained by the other. On account of the crash hat, Daisy is sometimes misgendered. I think it's all right to show off on your bike if you're four. At the time of writing, I'm 59, and approaching that phase of life when, like any child, I want to flag up that I can ride a bike. One by one, my contemporaries are relinquishing their bikes, and therefore also, in due course, some of their trousers, as their waistlines expand. That said, I shouldn't think many people cycle on ordinary bikes, on ordinary roads, purely for reasons of physical health, with no regard for where they're going or what they see on the way. But cycling for reasons of mental health, that's a different matter. I suspect a lot of people cycle because it makes them feel or think better. Cycling UK surveyed 11,000 regular off-road cyclists, and the number saying they cycled primarily for mental health benefits exceeded the number who said they cycled for reasons of physical health. In my experience, cycling stimulates the imagination, which might explain why some of my favourite writers have been cyclists. In the week in October 1891, when Arthur Conan Doyle wrote perhaps the finest Sherlock Holmes story, The Adventure of the Speckled Band, he and his wife rode from their South Norwood home to Woking on their tricycle tandem, a distance of 28 miles. Bikes, incidentally, are important in two Holmes stories, The Adventure of the Solitary Cyclist and The Adventure of the Priory School. In the latter, Holmes works out the direction the bike is going in from its tyre tracks. But in fact, it's probably impossible to do that. There was a big correspondence about the matter in the Strand magazine. Holmes himself was, or is, not a cyclist, and yet was still familiar with 42 types of tyre tread. And then there are the two cycling Bennetts, Alan, who I have twice seen cycling around North London, and Arnold. As a young man in the London of the 1890s, Arnold Bennett would cycle from his lodgings in Chelsea to watch the sunrise from Tower Bridge, or he'd go further afield, to Halifax, for instance. In her biography of Bennett, Margaret Drabble writes that riding a bicycle was not unlike writing a novel. Both were good for exercising the will. In a letter of 1896 to a friend, Bennett wrote of cycling, "It is noble, I tell you. Distances entirely disappear." I have saved Arnold Bennett till last, because it is clear from the environmentalist perspective of 2022 that cycling is even more noble than he knew. For what could be more noble than helping to save the world?